So, it can be claimed that depression is a relatively modern malaise. It is very much a product of our fragmented society, which is so rife with disharmonies. We lead fragmented lives in a fragmented world, and at the level of the individual, a major reason why depression comes to us is because our being is so fragmented. There is no obvious central rudder that one can guide it through the rather unquiet waters of today's society. The ego volunteers, but it is totally inadequate for the task. So from an integral perspective, depression can only be tackled at the roots, and we need a clear spiritual overview if we are to begin to conquer this affliction. This subject will be addressed by Dr. Long Pandey in the first session of this series, and will no doubt be reinforced in subsequent sessions. It requires a lot of persistence and sincerity to lift oneself out of this condition. If it sinks into our being, but I hasten to add, it is not impossible at all. To project the mother's wisdom, why would we be faced with a difficulty if we were incapable of conquering it? Which is precisely the reason why it has come to us. So Dr. Long Pandey must be known, very well known to all of you, so an introduction scarcely be required. He is a medical doctor specializing in psychiatry, practicing at the Sri Aurobindo Ashram in Pondicherry. He has conducted many workshops on diverse subjects in India and abroad, and contributed numbers of articles on different subjects in various Indian and international journals. He has authored 3 books and is chief editor of All India Magazine, a monthly journal at the Sri Aurobindo Society. He's also founder editor of NAMA. So the subject of his presentation tonight is the roots of depression, the spiritual perspective. We hope that you all benefit this session and indeed the whole series. So over to you, Dr. Locke, and I'm sorry about the...
Jema. First of all, it's a bit of a paradox when you were introducing. It's a bit of a paradox when you were introducing that Dr. Alok Pandey is a psychiatrist and he's practicing in the Sri Aurobindo Ashram. So people often ask me, "What is the psychiatrist doing at the ashram?" Because one expects that it should be free from all maladies and free from all problems. Free from all difficulties. So I'll share a little anecdote which I was just sharing with my friend, and then I'll come to the subject. So someone who has been, you know, keen to stay in Auroville asked me, can you tell me something about Auroville? What is Auroville? So I said it's a heaven. So the person asked that, what about ashram? What is the ashram? I said ashram is beyond heaven. Beyond heaven. So the person naturally asked, what do we have to do to transit from heaven to beyond heaven? I said, you have to pass through hell. So basically, see, depression is an acute reminder that, you know, we are fragmented, we are divided, but not just as a society. That's a way to look at it. Yes, society is fragmented today, and there are several reasons for it. But depression has been known in all cultures, in all ages. If we really look at, you know, the Trojan War, that era, then King Ajax went into depression, wanted to commit suicide. As back as, you know, the sage Vasishtha, when he lost his sons, he wanted to actually jump into the river, and the river got its name Bipasha because it broke open he had tied himself that I'll jump into the river, and it broke open all his bonds. And then there is a depression documented in King Shantanu, who went through a lot of pain and suffering because he loved someone and she had put an impossible condition, which ultimately Bhishma resolves. So basically depression has always been there, but yes, in a way it is true that it has become very prominent in these times, and the reason is threefold. First reason is the fast pace of life. So earlier, when the pace is slow, the stress is much less because one is not under any kind of a performance anxiety. And the society was very well stratified. It was given a kind of social order. So the high performance things, for example, the military, the administration or knowledge systems, was given to those who were to work hard for it. But not everybody was supposed to be, in that line of competition. But now, because of the democratic process, generalization of mankind, all this is nice things. But it has built a stress because everyone wants to be a contender for the top position as human beings conceive it. It's not always possible because human nature is stratified. Whether we like it or not, the fact is that people have different capacities, different faculties, they are different swadharma, which we are slowly beginning to realize. So this is one of the reasons that when you generalize things, then it's like everybody is put into the same race, which one may not be equipped to. And we remember the famous Aesop's fable where in the race, tortoise and horse, hare, who comes first? And the story ends very strangely that, slow and steady wins the race. This is not true in real life situation. What is true is that the tortoise should ask the hare that, well, this is an unfair race if both of us have to run on level ground. Let's have a race in water and then we will see who wins the race. So one of the things of the generalization of, everything in mankind is that we have forgotten this subtle truth that each one is built in a certain way. It's a kind of nature's design, and we need to discover it, respect it. It brings a kind of humility in our approach to life, and a kind of reality in our approach to life. So this is one part of it. I remember one of my classmates whom everybody would laugh because, everybody means many of you, because he couldn't perform well in studies. But this boy had a wonderful capacity to do sketches, and his Hindi was excellent, but things which were never valued. But he ended up doing very well in life simply because he capitalized on these things. So one part is this kind of a highly competitive individualism, if I may say so. And especially because the whole criteria nowadays is about wealth equal to success, and wealth equal to comfort, quality of life. So there is a complete narrative which is creating an unnecessary stress in modern times. The second reason is that because of the evolutionary niches, the evolutionary pressure, now from the social sense in which largely communities lived, like all of us have in our childhood, at least one generation before, it was the society which was important. So people lived according to the social norms. It created stress, but it also created a lot of buffers. So now, because of the new age requirement, there is a lot of stress on individuality. Mankind has entered a subjective age. And in this subjective age, while this is necessary, we discover the individual. But before we discovered the true individual, we discovered the vital individuality and the ego individuality. So this is the second reason why this has happened. And the third is a great degree of social mobilities, and which leads to dislocations. It's known, people are well, integrated in a society, but suddenly they move. And then when they move to new places, new culture, they are unable to always adapt, and it creates problems. There are other reasons also, but we need not go into it because today we'll talk about the roots of depression. So, yes, one thing is there, that the society, more than fragmented, before we touch the roots, is because it has placed false values. That's how the mother puts it, that almost an exclusive importance on material success. And this goes at the very education, even the parents' level. Parents believe that their child will fulfill their dreams when he grows up. And the whole stress is on material success. And obviously, when you go into this kind of a, I use the word abyss, of constant fear, desire, pleasure and pain, because the problem of material success is that you don't know where it really ends, because there is no closing point. So I use a little analogy that when people didn't have anything, and if God appeared and asked that, ask something, so they would probably ask for a few things, just few things. And when people have a few things and God appears, they will ask for a few more things. And when they have few more things and God comes, they say, we want many more things. And when they have many more things and God appears, they would ask everything. So this is because it puts you into a kind of, it doesn't matter whether one has any, you know, any competition outside or not. The whole atmosphere is such that every day, like, you know, we were just discussing that I need a change of cell phone. Somebody was, you know, suggesting. I said, see, I will still do work the same way as I work with one finger. And it will have probably some extra features, but I don't really need it. But you see, what happens today, the mind has become that, well, whether it's needed or not, and the companies will make it in such a way that your cell phone becomes more or less defunct in many ways after a few years. So it's like the whole world has been put into a loop of market and the wealth, and people are running after it. We see now the tariff war, and I mean, it's a horror, a nightmare, to say the least. So people are losing their true connect, inner connect, you know, because if they follow the voice of their inner being, they may not be able to earn wealth. And it has gone into, I mean, so much wealth. And it goes into the head that if I don't, I will have a, my life will not be success. It won't be a success story. So basically, there is an inversion of values. And this inversion of values, at least in India we had beautiful values, I must say. We have largely lost it because we have also gone into aping a kind of social paradigm where an external success, what is known as a material and vital success, is all that matters. This was not so when people were, you know, not respected because of the dress they wear or the vehicle which they drive, but their real knowledge was really revered. So we have still the ancient stories. If you read, they will say there was once a poor Brahmin, very full of knowledge, but he was poor, but he was a man who was respected because of his knowledge. So now, of course, poverty equals to whatever. So even those who try to correct it, do it by, you know, they're still giving importance to wealth. Let's say on one side is the capitalism, on the other side communism. So communism is no better, because what does it say? It says there is an unequal distribution of wealth. So you need to snatch it in whatever way. So basically you are still giving importance to that same old thing, which is the cause of, you know, problem. So the world needs to, you know, understand that the real values, things which are of lasting values, they cannot be bought by money. I think if this much people can understand, as the mother puts it, they are peace, light, joy, beauty, love. All this you cannot buy with money. There used to be a very nice advertisement long back. I won't name the product because then it will be almost like advertisement, but it was a very nice advertisement where the person says, there are certain things you cannot buy, and it listed, like it said, peace, love, harmony, and then it says, for all the rest you have XYZ card. So I said, this is so beautiful. I mean, it communicates that, well, on one side you can buy everything with the card, but these are the things you cannot buy. So this understanding, if it comes into the head, which requires a mammoth work, because webinars like these, which you are organizing, James, I must say, and many such efforts which are going on for humanity to awaken to this its true need. Now, what is the true need? That takes us to the real root. So, at one level, but even before that, at one level, depression is can have roots in the physical, vital, mental consciousness. This sense of fragmentation, let's put it like that. So, this fragmentation is not just horizontal, it is vertical, but I'll come to that in a moment. So, at the most material level, physical level, we know that seeds of heredity can be transmitted. Basically, it means that DNA not only documents patterns, it transmits them by genetic mechanisms. But because the DNA does transmit the patterns, now there is talk going on that one can, a generation can undo it, reverse it. This is how I see the story of Bhagirath and the Ganges. That there are patterns, there are generations which suffer because of, you know, some reason for, that's a theory, there are theories, we need not go into it. Why, what is the advantage of depression? Because there is a mutation which takes place and generations begin to go through depression. Probably, anyways, that's a long subject, I'll not get into it. But basically, if there is a physical seed of heredity, still it can be undone. The point that I am trying to say is that it can still be undone because body is not everything. There are other parts which are higher in the hierarchy and they can impose themselves upon the body. Provided the doctors don't mesmerize the mind and make us believe that, well, it's all about molecules, it's all about your genes. You cannot do anything about it. This is unfortunately not true. And this lie is being peddled all around. I mean, to say the least, there is no evidence for it. Forget about everything else. Is there an evidence that you cannot change? No, there is no evidence. But yes, people try to work on molecules and, you know, they give medicine and it does help. But that's another subject. Let me come back to the second root. The second root, mainly the source of depression is in the vital nature, not so much in heredity. If the vital is very strong, you can override the physical seeds. I mean, I have known people who inherited, there was a bad inheritance, but they're vital. Vital is the seat of energy. So basically it means, well, you may have a good engine, but if the energy is poor, you still, the engine still gets clogged. Or if the fuel that you are putting is a very adulterated fuel, so the engine will get spoiled. Now, if the engine is bad and you have a good fuel, so again there will be a problem. So, vital is the fuel, the kind of energy that, you know, is driving us. So, wherever one is driven by energies of fear, ambition, and most importantly, desire in general, so there is a tendency for depression. And there are various reasons why desires and its offshoots, fear and ambition, it brings in depression is because even when it gives me happiness, this happiness becomes very precarious. Itself becomes a cause of depression. So very often we will see that that which gave us happiness becomes tomorrow a cause of depression. Because it's one thing to get a wish fulfilled. It's very different to maintain it, to have the same value derived out of it. Because over a period of time, things tend to lose their value. I often, you know, in couples who come and they have a problem, very often in the beginning everything was wonderful. So, I tell them that you expect that the same joy will last as it happened on day one or, you know, maybe first year. But nature, vital nature doesn't operate like that. It needs a change. So it's a strange thing, you know, because it cannot, because it needs a variety. It's by nature, this is how the vital is. Why it is so, you know, you can discuss it morally, you can discuss it otherwise. But vital is something which almost demands that, well, even if everything is wonderful, everything is good, still it needs a change because that's how it is towards newness, fashion. See how people discard their old dresses even though they are serving well and they want to buy a new dress. How new food catches in fashion. So wherever relationship is based on the vital, it will create problems. So what is the solution? Solution is not listen to the vital and go through change. Solution is to evolve the relationship from merely a vital based relationship to a more intellectual companionship and if possible to a higher spiritual kind of togetherness. So this is about, same thing applies to any object we have, that if we hold the same object purely from the vital point of view, after a while it begins to give us, you know, we are not no more happy. It's like you buy a very nice thing and the day you bought it and got it, you have kept it very beautifully, showcased it. How many times does one look at it after a few days? Because, you know, the eyes don't go. Once in a while you will tell people, after some time even that is lost because you want something else. So this is how. But if you take it that, well, this is not about an object that I got. There is a story behind it. There is a intrinsic value of the object. Maybe somebody gifted. Maybe, you know, it. The mind associated it with some kind of a critical inner event. Then one tends to value it and preserve it and value it forever. So basically we have to take a re-look at everything in our life. At young age, vital nature is very strong. That's why we see depression and suicidal tendencies much common in the adolescents. Also because the nature is unsteady. So because vital by its nature is unsteady, it's very restless. So one of the signs that desire manifests itself is by simply restlessness. Even if it doesn't take a mental form. So it will just create restlessness. The people who can't admit or don't want to admit a desire. But desire is like an energy which will create restlessness. And it has to be directed properly to, you know, for example, through sports, poetry, music. If you direct it nicely or through, you know, higher pursuits, intellectual pursuit, then that energy gets regulated and channelized. Otherwise, it will create problem. It will turn back and start, you know, anger, irritability, depression. All these are the results of a life lived primarily in the vital. So the cause of depression at a, you know, one of the main causes is living in the vital. Now, vital is everywhere in everyone. It's important also, but it should not govern. So when the vital governs, by that I mean that people who live by their moods. So when they live by their moods, they tend to, you know, react very strongly. They think this is me, this is true. They are identified with the vital and then they can easily get into anger, depression, shut themselves in a hole for a variety of reasons. Again, they'll be going into endless details. But I'll give one little example. If moods come, what should we do? So recently I had a little joint pain and you know, one of the problems that you have is if you apply a simple kneecap, 100 people will ask you. So I said, okay, I better remove the kneecap and walk a little bit of limp chalega. So, or wear a full length trouser. So now people asked me, what is it? And I was just enjoying telling one story after another just for the joy. Then I picked on a name. I said, this is a new condition called moody arthritis. Okay, so they asked, what is moody arthritis? They say, it comes whenever it wishes to and goes away whenever it wishes to. So they asked, what do you do for it? I said, don't pay attention. Anybody in a bad mood, if inside there is a part which is in a bad mood, it applies to human beings also. Don't try to console a person who is in a bad mood, bad temper. Everything you will do will only feed the temper. And supposing by some means, after a lot of effort, the temper becomes quiet. Now, next time the person will have a bad temper, which invariably the person will have, he or she will expect exactly the same response, the same degree of response to quieten down. So you are putting two bad habits. One is that temper is okay. And second is you are getting the person habituated to a whole pattern. So what should one do when these moods arise? Ignore them. Or be reasonable. Mother says, you know, be reasonable. By be reasonable means this world, one of the central defects, as Sri Aurobindo says in The Life Divine, that is we believe that the world and God, they are all supposed to be centered around us. They must do things according to what my wish, desire, need is. Whatever I may think my need is, God is the omnipotent someone who is supposed to provide it. Now here I feel there is a civilizational problem. Because when we grew up generally in a joint family where, I mean, I didn't grow up in a joint family, but I know people who grew up in a joint family. Sometimes they had more children And there was not so much attention given to children. And children were told to sort out their things, you know, by themselves, which in a way was very good training. Mother speaks of it. She says that whenever she would complain of something, her physical mother will say, "Come on, you're not born for these things. Don't make fuss." And she says she was a lady with an iron will. So some of us have grown up like that, you know. It was not like the moment we had a wish and parents were rushing. Also, they didn't have so much of money as we have today. Now the equation has changed. From childhood, we are giving an idea to the child that life revolves around you. It's a very bad message, and it's going in the name of love. This is not love. If this is the criteria of love, then God doesn't love us at all. Because there are plenty of things he denies. There is a line in Savitri, "Heaven's wiser love rejects the mortal's prayer." To give blindly, and first time I saw, you know, parents going out of the way to buy the child an expensive toy. Excuse me, this is a wrong way to live. This is absolutely in the name of freedom, love, whatever. I don't know where this thing has come up because maybe one child norm or two child norm. But it's very unhealthy. It's giving a very wrong message to children. And when they grow up, they expect the same thing. Imagine a child which has grown up with this idea, gets married. She expects the husband or wife to do the same way, but the person cannot. Or when he turns to God, expects God to behave the same way. God must fit into my idea. So basically, here comes what mother says, that it's an egoistic illness. So what does the ego do? It believes life and everybody should move around me. Even people want planets to move, you know, around them. And I'll give you a very funny example. So people do Jyotish. So they say that, you know, your Rahu, Ketu, whatever it is, achha nahi chal raha hai. Now, I have my understanding of astrology. I have my own regard for every science. So I'm not getting into it. But they say that, you know, ye tumhara theek nahi hai. So what do we do about it? They say we will do Graha Shanti. So I asked them, do you mean that you are going to control the planetary systems by doing this? I mean, even the planet should move around to satisfy an individual's. But if you really take a spiritual look, then Rahu Ketu are not at all, there is nothing which is harmful. I mean, if you look into there, Rahu comes to challenge us. He creates mountains of difficulties to see whether we are sincere in our resolve or not. And what does Ketu do? He turns all this energy during this period into spiritual pursuit. So basically, they act in conjunction. If you look this way, you see that difficulties are opportunities. They are a means of my spiritual progress. And actually, if we look at life, you know, Kunti's prayer comes to mind. The other day in Bhagavad, we were reading this, that, you know, Kunti says at the end of the war and when Krishna is finally departing from Hastinapur to Dwarka, Kunti says, she says, you know what, that whenever we were in deep distress, we prayed to you and you intervened. You came and intervened. Now, this is something very beautiful that you intervened. So she said, I would like life after life to go through these difficulties to experience your coming and your intervention. Of course, that's not the highest prayer, but still it's very touching. That the divine intervention, because, you know, in distress we call for that intervention, we try to stretch our limits, we try to bring out our best, even those who don't believe in divine, doesn't matter, because people often say, you people talk about divine, I don't believe in divine. So I tell them that, well, doesn't matter, divine believes in you. So he will still come if you try to bring out your best. And sometimes, very frankly, doing too many this may hurt a few sentiment, too much reliance on puja part, it creates a problem, because then you don't bring out your own strength, because you're always passing the blame to someone. So like people ask that, where was God when Somnath temple was attacked? So I tell them, well, because God wants you to embody Shiva. And the day in India, Bharatvarsh, people embodied Durga and Shiva in Guru Gobind Singh and Sivaji and Maharana Pratap and all these people, the Britishers ran away. So it's not about doing something external. Depression is a reminder you have to do something within you, whether you believe in God or doesn't believe in God. This is the reality. and do something, that there is a challenge life poses to us and there are issues and problems. But yes, if you can make a conscious turn toward the divine and seek help while doing your effort, then there is, the possibilities are limitless, because even then the divine will help, whether we believe it or not, because it's a job description. But we'll probably be close to the help, we will resist the help inwardly. So it's very beautiful when we put in our effort to come out of this state, because it's not something good, it's not something desirable, it's not something healthy. Even a rational mind will be able to tell us. So Mother says, be reasonable. So this is the physical and vital depression. And then of course it generates itself in the mind also. Though mind is a domain which is largely free of depression, because if reason becomes active, it really takes care of depression. And one of the things which I have seen people, who don't believe in God, who don't believe in yoga and other things, but simply by the help of reason, they can take care of their vital. That's why we see in the Gita, the first lesson to Arjuna is discerning intellect. Buddhi Yog. Awaken your intelligence, look at things. For example, somebody weeps and cries and laments over death. I can understand an untimely death is a cause for sorrow. But 80, 85 people, when they lament, well, one can only remember what Sri Krishna says in the Gita, that are you the first one who is ever dying, who is witnessing death? Death is part of the planet. And if you didn't know this till date, that means you have not lived your life in a very rationally conscious way. So even if one can awaken the discerning intellect, it's a great remedy. It helps to keep the vital in moderation, keeps our expectation in moderation. Sometimes people say in a relationship, you mean that we should have no expectation? I said, no, that's very difficult. But you can have expectations reasonably. There are reasonable expectations, which as one human being, we know our own limits and we can expect from the other person given the same situation. With empathy, we can understand that what a person can do and cannot do. So if you are reasonable, you will moderate the expectation. No expectation is asking a yogic something, effort. So this is the three layers on which depression takes. But where are the roots? Where does the sense of fragmentation begin? And there we have to go back to the story of creation itself, because everything ultimately goes back to a spiritual problem. So we know that this creation, I am cutting a long story short, is the result of an appearance of separation. There can be no real separation from the point of view of the divine. But there is a veil of ignorance. It's like the egg is, the tree deposits all its energy inside a seed. So if the seed were to experience outside, within itself, it won't see the tree. But the tree has nurtured it and caged it, and then it drops it into the ground where the seed is all alone. So creation begins something like that. So in all of us there is a divine seed, and in all of us there is a layer of ignorance. And the mother describes that's where creation begins, in the inconscient. And in that state the first SOS goes. It's a state where there is an extreme kind of loneliness, feeling of being abandoned, feeling of being rejected. They all originate from there, actually. A feeling of being separate from everything else. So, as I say, loneliness is not a physical thing. Loneliness is a emotional thing. You know, one may be with people and yet feel lonely. And there are people who are alone and they enjoy their loneliness because they don't feel alone. My friend laughing. But it's so true. I mean, I enjoy it. But there are people who are with family, who are with friend, but they become lonely because it's an inner state. And the origin of this state is when creation was cut off from the divine. It was necessary as a challenge. And therefore comes this, that the roots of, the final roots of depression is basically when the sense of being cut off from the origin. And we try to reach that origin in number of ways. For example, when we say, I want to be the center of the universe, it's only the origin which is the center of the creation. The only way you can ever get at that is by uniting with the divine. Because you'll find yourself at the center of everybody and everything. But then it won't be in an egoistic sense. You will have deep compassion, deep wisdom, because you understand everybody from inside out. So this is where the root lies, the sense of separation, which gets very, very crystallized and strengthened by the ego sense. Now, I could go, I think we had a whole discussion on ego and the individuality and its purpose, why ignorance has come into existence. So I will not get into that because that's a long subject. It is there in the Life Divine. Also, there are talks on this, that why the sense of ego was created at all. But the beauty is that the more we feel, begin to feel lonely, the more we feel vulnerable, alone, the more we are actually ready for something to burst open within this shell of the ego. So when the individuality is not really developed, then man lives by the group, law of the group. This is what I was saying in the beginning. So, you know, society restricts, but society also takes care. This was a generation or two before us, where society, there were do's and don'ts which you accepted. But at the same time, society supported you. Whenever there was a problem, the whole group life would take care. But now there is the individuality, phase of individuality. So there is a phase when the ego is feeling stifled. It wants to burst forth, break free. It is allowed now because society is no more restricting it. But at the same time, it means it has to face the world. So that support system which was there during the earlier phase, that is also taken away. So it's a real adventure for the individual who feels shut within its egoistic limits, feels the sense of separateness, loneliness, has dreams about the future, but doesn't know how to realize it because there is nobody tangible help outside. And that's where comes the real solution, because the sense of separativeness in its origin belongs to the creation being enveloped by ignorance. Therefore, there is the sense of separativeness, because from the side of the divine, there is never any separativeness. And we can take this example of supposing I have shut myself in a room, pulled the curtains all around, thick curtains, and switched off the lights, or the lights have gone away. Now what happens? Even when the sun rises outside, it is there, but it has no access because I have closed myself. So ignorance is like that. It makes us feel, perceive, as if I am all alone and there is nothing like a divine reality, nothing like a greater truth, a higher consciousness which can help me. So what has to be done? We have to open the door. Yes, divine can also shatter open, but then it can be very unnerving, intimidating. Imagine in that dense darkness, like a baby comes out of the womb and is flooded by light. So the divine wants us to make some effort in that state. Ignorance is a pitiable state. So first stage of ignorance is you enjoy it. And the next step is state is that you start getting the kickbacks or the payback. And the payback time is when you no longer enjoy that state which you were enjoying earlier. This is, and you want something else. You don't know what you really want. You still fall back on the old methods. Maybe if I change my friend, I will get happiness. Maybe if I buy a new car, maybe if I change my job, I'll get happiness. Because the old methods. But they become worse and worse. Because it's not the problem and it's not the cure. So where is the cure? We have to open that inner door, as the mother says, you want to die? Die then. Die to the ego. And when that takes place, then magic starts. Then depression will be miles away. Everything in life appears different, because now you are joining with the divine. And this union first takes place in some vantage point within us, maybe the mind, maybe the heart. Maybe in the soul ground, if it takes place in the ground of the soul, very wonderful, because then soul becomes the master and starts changing your life. But supposing in the heart, then fundamentally one escapes from depression, and yet sometimes depressive thoughts may come because the mind has not yet joined the divine. So still there will be a tendency, proclivity in the mind, because mind still feels separate because the jnana is not come. So if you see it like, but at the same time, if the jnana comes, the mind is illumined, but the heart is separate. You see, why would Rishi Vasishtha experience depression? Precisely because one part may be illumined, but the other part may still feel the sense of separateness. The people who are intellectuals, pandits, even sometimes they have had glimpses, and yet they are prone to depression because the heart and the vital remains the same, unpurified, not open to the divine. That's why if we ask, the real solution is an integral yoga. At least the yoga of the Gita, which is integral by its nature, if not the yoga of transformation. Shri Krishna says something very interesting in the Gita. He says, yoga is done by a glad and not a despondent heart. So in the Gita, there are many interesting cryptic verses. For example, yoga karma shukoslam. So people take it that if I do my karma very well, I am doing yoga. No. If you do yoga, your karma will be kaushal, will be kushal. There will be perfect skill in work. Similarly, yoga is done by a glad and not a despondent heart. If you are doing the yoga correctly, you will have a glad and not a despondent heart. One can almost take it like a barometer. That if you are depressed, things are not right. There are people here also who get depressed. Because somewhere one has missed something very important, something very crucial. And that's where we have to rectify, to open all the doors to the divine. Not just the mind and thought, the heart with love of the divine, the life with service of the divine. And even then, the body sometimes, because as I said, seeds can be in the inheredity. So they may throw up a wave from here and there. But if one keeps open and even opens the body, then ultimately at every level, we are curing it. So basically union with the divine, because separation from the divine is the ultimate root. The separation has become very acute today because it's a very egoistic individuality which is being favored today by nature. There is a purpose. It's the heart shell within which the little baby psychic being is developing. So it's a phase, and because of that we have entered into things like competitive individualism and many such things which are a kind of ego individualism, where, you know, I'll do whatever I feel like. Though law comes, law is what? Reason guiding us. You can't do anything and everything. There's some kind of a governance from above. So basically, if we open the mind to the higher consciousness, to the divine, then we look at things correctly, rightly, in the right proportion, in the right measure. One of the problem of depressive thoughts is that it overgeneralizes, over exaggerates something, or it under, you know, like as it's commonly said, you don't count your blessings when you are depressed. You see all the things which are happening. The other day, one of my very close ones, she was saying, I was praying to Mother and to God, and yet my cat died. So does God really hear prayers? I said, countless times you have told me that, you know, you prayed and God answered. If once the cat has died, leaving aside the explanation behind it, you feel unhappy about it and start putting a veil between you and the divine. You are sacrificing your relationship with divine just because something has happened, which is, you know, it's like a transactional relationship with divine doesn't work, take us very far. One has to learn to give, to love the divine, to know the divine for the joy of knowing the divine. So here also we must understand transactional relationships in the end. One, because God cannot satisfy our desires, because to do that, actually it's very silly, because that means there is no dharma in the world, there is no karmic law in the world. If God is there to satisfy all our desires, then the law of karma goes for a six. And dharma goes, because he is there, he will satisfy. How can it be possible? Common sense and logic would tell us he is not meant to do that. He may, but eventually only for you to get an experience that I have taken a long route. The shorter route would have been without going through it. Maybe, you know, denial of desire is much better from the divine point of view. So all this is just in the backdrop. So mind, when it opens to the divine, the right thoughts begin to come automatically. It's described in Savitri. We don't have to try to think positively. In everything, we will see the correct measure, correct proportion, what is there behind the event that is happening, what direction I should take. So there are people who break down when they go through depression. There are people who are reborn. So always when we have such crisis moments, it's like Sphinx. So we have two choices, either to die or to be reborn. In fact, death is a way of being reborn. So some people just die and they are not reborn. I mean, talking figuratively. But others take it as an opportunity to die to their old self and be reborn. So this is the difference. So, you know, intellectually one can take it like that. Emotionally also. Emotionally, again, who can really fulfill all the longings of love? A friend who can be 24/7. Maybe a few days he will be in the beginning. But after some time, he will say, look here, I also need rest. I have my own life. He may start expecting the same from the other person. But yes, divine is there 24/7. This I can say, and all who have gone through this can say that 24/7, poor fellow, doesn't sleep. And countless people are asking him all kinds of nonsense and he responds in his own way. I just sometimes feel, if at all you have to feel pity, you have to feel to be in the shoes of God. I mean, I know he does it, he has his operating system. But I just feel, so sometimes I feel, if instead of always asking the divine, if he can just say a prayer of gratitude. That thank you for giving me another day. Thank you for keeping me today at this moment healthy enough. Thank you for giving me aspiration, showing me the path, of showing me a goal. Thank you for the little things of life. Gratitude. It's so beautiful. So at least, you know, we'll make God's work one step. At least one person is out of his list of maintenance. He will maintain anyways. But poor fellow, he has such a tough time. I'm saying he's a very good friend. So from that point, he can be, he's the best friend actually. Similarly, all this may be there. Still life may, waves of depression may come from all around. Because our life energy is still around the little things of life. Little aims, little, you know, money earning, etc. Life energies are not turned toward the divine. So these should also be turned toward the divine for at least to live for a higher purpose, to work for something like an ideal, if not the divine service itself. And this way, slowly, and once the life is caught by the divine joy, then the body automatically gets affected because they are intimately connected. So this is a broad canvas, and I have tried to just rush through and touch upon some of the salient points. Jema, so if you have question now, otherwise I am sure you will post it on the folder and must have made a group. So please feel free to put questions there also. There is no problem. Because sometimes, you know, one has to hear again and assimilate it. Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you, Dr. Long. So if anyone has any questions or comments they'd like to make, please fire away now.
Namaskar, may I ask a question?
Yes, yes, sure. Please.
Of course, please.
Alok sir, I have two questions. The first question, as a common man, when we talk about discerning intellect,
yes,
the question is about mass, for all the people. As a person and as a clinician, I see this discerning intellect is a miss in majority of people.
Yes, agreed, 100%.
And the second question comes as a psychiatrist. I am professor of psychiatry, sir.
Yes, sir.
So, I missed half of this lecture as I am traveling. Today we are discussing depression, stands with clinical depression, or includes clinical depression also?
Includes clinical depression. Includes clinical depression and everything else as a more of a generic term, not just classically like, you know, endogenous and neurotic. I have not gone into that direction because that's a very specialized subject. But depression in general includes clinical depression. And as you know, being a psychiatrist, I also deal with it. So I do feel that with regard to mass, there are two things. One is the cure has to be at the level at which the patient is able to receive it. So if somebody is at the level of the physical consciousness, and if we start telling him that, no, you can undo these patterns, etc., he is not ready. So I have met people who come and ask me that, you know, I want medication. And, you know, you give medication, they respond very fast. I'm sure you do very much the same. But there are people in whom they are ready for the awakening of the discerning intellect, what is nowadays known as cognitive therapy, though not exactly in this term, but it principle is the same. Though a spiritual cognitive therapy will be a little different and much better. It will be all a better package. So one can, you know, do that. Here again, we are not bringing in the spiritual or the higher principle. But there are those who, in whom depression is actually an existential crisis. If you read, you know, the memoirs of some of the saints, there have been some Indian saints, but the more common in recent times is Eckhart Tolle, who went through a phase of depression for a long period. Till something bust open. So I see these patients more and more who will present with, you know, classical depression and who are basically going through an existential crisis. This is becoming more and more common for the reasons which I was mentioning, that the age of individuality. So in them, we have to assist them to come out of this shell and open to a higher consciousness. I have seen such patients and clients, and they not only recover from the depression, they take a leap. So the vital depression, they will go into the hyper mode and come back here because they have, nothing has really changed fundamentally. But there is a kind of depression which is because of an existential thing. It has to be picked up. It's a kind of specialized thing. And then if you can assist, it's like helping the soul to, I may use the word jail delivery, like Krishna was delivered in the jail. And if that can happen, then it's like not only a cure of depression, but a leap toward the future. So I've seen that also. Yeah, so different possibilities. Yes, James, anything else?
Anyone else want to ask any questions? Any more comments? Or...
Mm-hmm.
Yes, please. Hello.
I want to say something or ask.
Yes, Ashwara, please.
I heard so much, but I still don't understand how will the vital turn to the divine, or it always wants newness, it wants to go up and down, it's very sensorial based.
Yes, so step one is you cannot suddenly turn, let's say a vital which is not listening toward the divine. So it has to be first taught by reason. So that's what I meant by the discerning intellect. Because otherwise an untrained vital, you have to first tame the wild horse before you can be, it can be used by the master rider. So, you know, the taming part has to be done by the mind, by sattvic impulsion. If you take the Indian thought of the three gunas, rajas has to be mastered or tempered or moderated by the sattva-gun. So sattva-gun is about reason, is about shastra. Shastra is difficult nowadays. You know, what is the collective wisdom? And one has to be reasonable if one wants to use a modern language. And then once the vital becomes a little bit trained and tamed, then it is ready for spiritual turning. But otherwise it's difficult. It's like a leap. Some it may happen, but with most people it keeps on. I mean, even if you join an ashram, let's put it like that, you still have to go through this phase. Otherwise people may continue living and continue cribbing. It's like, because you can't help it. The vital is untamed. So you have to go through the process of discerning intellect. This is what I've seen, that, you know, none can escape it. Even if somebody purely by the emotional being opens to the divine will ensure that at some point you will get into that discerning intellect. Otherwise there will be a flip-flop. You will have ecstatic moments and then, you know, down the dump, because this reason is a mediator. It has to be used. It has its place in the yoga. We can't dispense away with it. So so first reason, then beyond reason. Yeah. Meanwhile, opening in whatever level, in whatever way, will continue. Understood. Turning to the Divine Mother, working for the Divine is a wonderful way. So one can always work. Work itself is a purifier. Even in general, work is a purifier. Because it hits at our egoism very hard. you start working, you realize that, well, everybody has their point of view. So people don't care about your point of view. They have their own point of view. So work is a great purifier. And in the ashram, even more. So collective work anywhere, it helps. It's a great help. And at the same time, it also brings out things which are hidden. It channelizes the restless vital. It also brings some rewards. Like in the ashram context, if you know, suddenly there's a special food. So everybody says, so nice. So it's like those little things which are like the salt and spice and sugar of life. So, yeah. So intellect and work. These are the two things which help. Yeah.
So one has to develop the intellect by reading or...
Reasoning. Reading doesn't really... I mean, reading can develop, but practicing, every time there is a wave of depression, the reason, one has to bring forth the reason, is the guide. That is it really right? How does it help? To tell you one example. Like, you know, people sometimes come complaining and this, that, for about everything. So one of the things I ask them, which is where reason comes in. Okay, fine, the world is horrible, bad, everything. People are very bad. Okay, taken. Now, what is relevant to try to analyze all that or what you are going to do about it? So you see, what will reason tell us? Reason will tell us I have to do something about it. So it, you know, reason works in so many ways. So when you have to do something about it, then you may make a decision, correct choice. But if I keep on, why this happened, so and so did this, over-analyzing the cause is, you see, that's why in certain forms of psychotherapy where you analyze, you continue for years. Because you can analyze, there are so many ways, but the point is here and now. This is where I stand today. What do I do from here? World is bad, fine. People were very unkind to me. Okay, taken. Let's not try to understand whether they were kind or unkind or my perception. Now, what do I do from here? It's my life. I got to take charge of my life. Nobody is there with me, fine. Now, I have to take charge. I can't just say that nobody is there, therefore I'm helpless. I'm still there. My mind is still there. So, this is how one has to look at it. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor.
Yeah.
A couple of people have got their hands raised. Dordi, you want to speak, say something? Dordi?
Yes, I would just like to thank you for this hour today. It was very cheerful, and I really liked that there was so much humor, you know.
And thank you for the smile. It made me feel happy about, you know. Yeah, yeah.
One of the problems of depression is what you were saying, ego-centered, but also being too much serious.
Yes, too much serious, absolutely, absolutely. Thank you for bringing that out.
Yeah, but it's not so serious.
Yes.
Probably not serious.
Yes. So I put it like this, that there is somebody who has created the world, he's taking care of it. So, you know, you're getting serious leads to nowhere. So cheerfulness is no doubt something very special and a great quality. But well, some have it, some don't have it. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, yeah.
Karen, you want to ask something?
Yeah, thank you. It was a really nice session. And as Tori said nicely, you put really nicely. I have only one question.
Yes.
There are depression with a psychotic feature.
Okay.
How do you explain that, if you can?
Oh, that will be really a very big, I can answer you separately on a question, but basically psychosis is, just in a nutshell, since you have asked, it's a highly specialized question because many people may not be aware of the term psychosis. So psychosis in very, very brief is losing touch with the outer reality and one gets into another reality. Let me put it like that, because classical textbook will describe it that you are out of touch with reality. So instead of that, I use the term that one is no more in touch with the outer reality, but one enters into an alternate reality where all kinds of, you know, then delusion, hallucination, and partly one constructs things, and then, you know, there are actual play of forces. So that's but at the essence, root, what happens is normally ego also keeps us grounded. See, it's like I am dependent on my sensory reality and what I see appearances. Now imagine suddenly I use this example that supposing we begin to become aware of everybody's thoughts, how problematic that would be. So ignorance has its own advantages, you know. Otherwise, we take it on face value. Somebody came and said, oh, Pandeji, it's so nice, and I may take it on face value. Good for me. Supposing I get to see that behind this smile and compliment, there is something else which is waiting around the corner. It'll be, so what happens to a psychotic? The shell of the ego which protects, the ignorance which protects, bursts prematurely. And people float into a kind of a subliminal consciousness from where they can go down, up. It's like a cosmic consciousness in a certain sense, but in the cosmic ignorance. So they open to the play of very vicarious, diabolic play of forces, where they become a plaything in the hands of forces. So that becomes a very serious issue, because it's not just depression anymore, but the ego shell has burst prematurely. That's why there is a time. This idea of prematurely taking people into spiritual life is very dangerous, because one has to be ready. One has to, you know, feel the need for it. And if this shell bursts, there are people who do violent practices just to, you know, or for various reasons, that's a different subject. But if the ego shell breaks open, I mean, psychedelics do the same thing, then what happens? You enter into a totally disorienting alternate reality, where truth and falsehood is very badly mixed, and that's dangerous. So yes, antipsychotics do help, because at the molecular level they block the entry of certain forces, because everything here ultimately uses matter. So what you can do is, it's like, you know, somebody is projecting all kinds of dark films. So what do? You can't change the man's consciousness overnight, but you can certainly put a barrier between him and the projecting forces. So antipsychotics help in that way, because they block these molecular levels and it gives a vantage point. But one has to use that as an opportunity to grow. Otherwise, it's like as long as one lasts. Yeah, this is the shortest answer. Yeah.
Thank you, Doctor. And if you can give me a little bit
later. Yes, so there will be, I think James will... have otherwise people send me questions regularly on, there is a website called Ask Alokda. There is also Ask Alokda, which is askalokda@gmail.com. So, you know, anywhere one sends question, any question, I'll be very happy to whatever extent I can to reply. Yeah.
Or you can send a question on the chat.
Or you can send the question here on the chat. Okay, James, I have something at this point. So thank you.
And thank you very much for the very illuminating session. And until next week.
Yes.
See you, everyone.
See you.
Bye. Jay. Blessings.
Bye,
everyone.
Bye.